Support for NPR and the following message come from our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. Having a party? Whatever you're celebrating, Whole Foods Market has everything you need for a spectacular event. Premium meats, prepared foods, desserts, and more. Start every celebration at Whole Foods Market.
A warning, this episode contains discussion of sexual assault. The new Netflix series Baby Reindeer has a lot of people talking, including us. It tells the haunting semi-autobiographical story of a man who becomes the romantic obsession of a mentally ill woman who proceeds to stalk him. Eventually, her threatening actions force him to address a past trauma in his own life that leaves him shaken and confused. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about Baby Reindeer on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. Planning a party or honoring a recent grad? Whatever the celebration, Whole Foods Market can make things easy, starting with some delicious marinated steaks, always antibiotic and hormone-free. Simple and easy eats are ready in the prepared foods department. And for dessert, how about a luscious berry chantilly cake? Not in the mood to cook? Their catering menu offers festive options ready to order online at shop.wfm.com. Start every celebration at Whole Foods Market. This message comes from NPR sponsor eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Finding someone who gets you on dating apps is hard. That's why eHarmony is different. eHarmony is designed to help you bring out your personality on your profile so you make more genuine connections. Take their compatibility quiz to get started and see for yourself. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today. This message comes from NPR sponsor, the official Hacks podcast from Max. Join the creators and showrunners of Hacks as they discuss each episode and speak with the cast and crew about the making of the series. Listen to the official Hacks podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Third Love. Third Love makes solutions for every bra problem. Give yourself more lift, smoothing, and get straps that stay put. Every style's wear-tested on real women, made from premium materials, with a virtual fitting room to help you find your perfect fit. Comfort and support are guaranteed. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with code PODCAST15.
Joining me today is comedian, writer, and actor Guy Branum from the Apple show Platonic. Welcome back, Guy.
Good to be here, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
Of course. In Baby Reindeer, Richard Gadd plays Donnie, a London bartender who's struggling to become a stand-up comedian. One day, a distraught woman named Martha bellies up to his bar, and he takes pity on her. Martha is played by Jessica Gunning. She proceeds to fawn over him, calling him Baby Reindeer and telling him a series of lies about herself, including that she's a high-powered attorney, even though she can't afford a drink.
God doesn't like a bragger, but when you're the go-to for the biggest political minds in the game, you've earned a brag or two.
No. I'm not going to say who, so don't even go there. Fine, David Cameron, Nick Clegg, Alex Hammond, but you didn't hear that from me.
Soon she is sending him an endless string of increasingly unhinged emails while threatening him and his family. There's considerably more to the story, but that's something the series doesn't reveal until its midway point. We'll get to that. Baby Reindeer is based on two autobiographical one-man shows written and performed by the show's star and writer, Richard Gadd, which earned him considerable acclaim. It is streaming now on Netflix. Guy, as I say, we'll get to the big reveal in a bit, but kick us off with your general impressions first off.
It was a very interesting series that I thought took some of the conventions that we have from that Edinburgh show that turns into limited series, very serious. Comedian, yeah. Going through complex stuff. I thought that it did a lot to shift and problematize, like, the centrality of Donnie as a character, to sort of, like, question the assumptions that we make about the people at the center of the story and the people at the periphery of a story. I was glad that I watched it, but I came away from it wanting to talk about it so bad that I emailed your producer and started texting you about how I wanted to talk about it.
That's the way it works, right? I mean, I think it's fascinating, and I think its ending is incredibly effective. We'll talk about that after the spoiler bit, but I like how quickly it dispenses with what you think it's going to be about. It dispenses with this notion of stalking is kind of sexy, kind of 80s erotic thriller, you know, hide the bunny. And if you just watch the opening minutes, you think it's trying to do that, to do away with that, just by making Martha fat. So we're going to get one bad joke. We're going to get Shallow Hal 2024. And we're watching the series through his eyes, as you mentioned, through Donnie's eyes. He's shaping how we see her. And at first, it's, I pity the fat girl. And if it stayed there, you don't have a show. That's not enough because Jessica Gunning is really bringing everything to make this character grounded and real and layered. You start to see how he gets fascinated by her, the sheer simple fact of her, the size of these lies. We need to see some of his fascination. We need to feel some of his fascination. And if she's not complex enough to stand up to it, there's no show. The true genius of the show, I think, is the bait and switch. This is not I'm being stalked by a mentally ill woman. I'm in danger. He's in emotional danger more than physical danger. And he quickly starts laying the track for, look, these are two broken people who are perfectly matched to each other in ways to make each other miserable, in finding each other's weak points. And what's happening here isn't unidirectional. He starts making bad decisions right away. He follows her home. He peeks in her windows. And I guess my first question for you is, like, that is a very important moment in the series, when he makes that decision to follow her home. And does his complicitness in this all ring true for you, or did it stop you?
My experience of the first couple of episodes was just frustration with the trope of sad, fat desire. Like, as a fat person, like, I was having to watch yet another show that was saying, it is a form of mental illness that this woman thinks that this man with kind of a messed up face, but abs, might be attracted to her. And I thought that we were going to be subjected to 7 episodes of that. And I was really frustrated and angry. And it was getting at a lot of my most fundamental issues. And when you do have that moment of pivot, when he goes after her, like, the floor drops out from under you and you enter a new and more complex space. And I think one of the things that this show does really effectively is get at deep, dark feelings, getting at the way that attraction is much more complex and varied and dirty than we usually give it credit for in media. You know, like, this was not a simple case of a person being, you know, bothered by somebody who was mentally ill, but somebody who found appeal in it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And why does he find appeal in it? That's the thing. That's the most important. The moment he follows her home is the most important moment in the show, I think, because it sets everything up. He is not making rational decisions. He, for some reason, needs this kind of attention from her.
But also, Glenn, let's take a moment for that house. Let's take a moment for the fat girl's dirty house that is full of takeout containers. Because how could a person be fat if their home wasn't full of takeout containers? Because they have to be eating all the time.
Exactly. But, I mean, you can't say that she's not giving it. There's an intensity to her performance, even when she's, like, giggling. And there's a rage underneath the surface that comes. So when it comes pouring out, it feels like, oh, I'm surprised, but I'm not. You know what I mean?
Exactly the right time.
Don't you touch him, bitch!
Martha, seriously.
I swear to God, you lay another finger on him, I'm going to wipe that lip from you, mark my words.
Seriously.
I think it's a really beautiful performance, and one of the aspects of my fat rage about this show is that it is definitely going, we already got the Deadline article where Richard Gadd has been signed by nice, fancy LA agency, and that's not going to happen for the woman who plays Martha. Like, we're not going to get her being treated as, like, a craftsman. She is just a fat girl who successfully did the job of being fat on television. You know, I think that the performance, like, really shows you so many sides and facets to this character. You understand the charm, you understand the appeal, you understand why Donnie as a character gets swept away by all of this, and you also see that seething underneath it is something. We never find out what that something is, just that it's real sad. And we do have that moment of him speculating, oh, the school dances she didn't get invited to. We all imagine that we are able to look at a fat person and just know what their backstory is.
Yeah, and that performance we're talking about, this is Jessica Gunning, and I hope she gets some attention from this. I mean, I hope you're wrong. She is giving so much to this series, but it is impossible to really talk about this show without addressing the reveal that takes place in the 4th episode. So, again, if you're listening and you want to stay completely unspoiled, stop listening now. Donnie reveals in that episode that 5 years before Martha entered his life, he met a successful television writer played by Tom Goodman Hill. He gave Donnie career advice, he promised him various professional opportunities, and supplied him with lots of drugs. And during those sessions, he sexually abused Donnie. This set Donnie off on what the show depicts as a shameful and morally degrading spiral of sex with both men and women, drug use, and quote-unquote extreme porn. He's unable to develop romantic feelings for another person until he meets Terry on a trans dating site. She's played by Nava Mao. Guy, how did that reveal and how the show dealt with it and its aftermath land with you?
I was surprised when it was first happening. First of all, it shifts the timeline. I was also probably playing Civ 6 while I was watching this. And so I did have that moment of like, wait, okay, so we're going back and this is the backstory that we're getting. And then as I saw it play out, I started to wonder whether I should be worried if this was good for the gays. Like, whether I had been so busy worrying about whether this was good for the fats that I didn't realize that it was going to splash onto another aspect of my identity. And it really portrays this relationship as being inherently dangerous and inherently coercive in a way that I do not think is supported by the facts, but is supported by the narrative and agency. Like, because this man tells us that, well, I didn't want to take these drugs, but he offered them to me. And I sure did spend a lot of time paying attention to and hanging out with this gay man and, you know, not really specifying whether he had been clear about only wanting a platonic relationship or not.
Right.
It really played into a lot of old tropes of gay predation that, you know, go back into the mists of time.
Yeah, boy, I got to be careful here because I wrote about how the show depicts Donnie's sexuality. And that's what I'm talking about, how the show depicts Donnie's sexuality. And I heard from some folks who I think it's fair to say misconstrued what I was trying to say. But first of all, I think the show handles Martha's mental illness well. I think it handles Donnie's abuse and trauma and how he deals with it well. I think it depicts Donnie's sexuality in a really clumsy, lazy way that is kind of dangerous. And I hate to come from a policing place to say that, but I mean, I think the show conflates the abuse with Donnie's queerness in a way that has really just left me cold. And it's not enough to say, well, this is based on his life. And how can you police another person's sexuality and say he didn't feel the way he felt? Well, first of all, and I'm going to stick a flag in this, this is not his life. This is a drama based on his experience.
Yes.
It is. He has said it's all emotionally 100% true, if that makes sense. It's all borrowed from instances that happened to me and real people that I met. And again, people, there is life, which is messy, and there's drama, which has to be shaped. The stuff in real life that sticks out, that connect, has to be filed down and simplified and made more direct. So there's real people and there are characters. And Gad created the character of Donnie, and the character of Donnie only manifests a queer sexuality after he is raped by another man. That is conflating abuse with sexuality in particular, queer sexuality in particular. What the show is implying, and whether or not it intends to imply it doesn't matter, because again, intent doesn't matter. What you made is what matters, is that the relationship between the abuse and Donnie's queerness is cause and effect. Queerness is something that happens to Donnie. It's this outside force that changes him in a very specific way. And that's where I just, the show lost me.
It's a very dangerous idea that is out there. It is like really unfortunate. Yes, abuse is something that happens to queer people the way that it happens to straight people, but the notion that it is like a disease that is imputed from one to another, like, goes back into old ideas of vampirism, you know, goes back into old ideas that we are converting people. And the way that American and British TV shows are built is just different. Like, British comedies have one writer. They have one perspective. They have one person who is shaping and filing down the truths. In America, we used to have series that were longer, and so we have larger writer's room where you can have different perspectives, different people weighing on how a story is being told. And there is a way that Baby Reindeer files down the personhood and agency of the people around Donnie enough to make sure that Donnie always is a sweet victim of circumstance and not somebody who is playing into his own journey. Like, the way that the story elides his spending a bunch of time seemingly dating this gay guy because he would like this guy to pay attention to him and help his flailing career is just sort of bounced over. The fact that this guy offered him drugs, as sometimes people in relationships and sometimes people in gay relationships do, and he accepted them, is presented as a kind of transgressive or manipulative act. And it is something that we are far more willing to take as a form of abuse or a form of grooming when it is happening from a gay man to a perceived as straight man than we are in situations if it were a woman who were older doing this to Donnie. I don't think we would be using the words grooming to describe what was going on.
Right.
And that is you know, very troubling for me because it plays into super old school tropes that have legal effect. Like in the United States, it's called the gay panic defense. In Britain, It's called the Portsmouth defense. But it is the idea that when a gay guy or trans woman hits on you, it is something dangerous and scary enough that if you react violently, it's not as bad. Like,
absolutely.
These ideas have actual effects. And like Richard Gadd benefits from the fact that he presents himself as a cis straight man for the first three episodes of this. And so we are able to say, oh, this gayness is happening to him. If he wants to tell queer stories, he needs to think about queer culture and his place in it.
Absolutely. And look, let's allow that this is exactly how Gadd experienced it. 100% straight arrow, then the abuse, then he's queer and he does identify as bisexual now. Even if it happened exactly that way, that is not enough. This thing that you created has to stand on its own. It can't draft on the fact that it's based on real life as a way to make it kind of invulnerable to critique, right? Because again, drama is shaped. Things are left out. Things are added in. The process of turning it into art, you are attempting to take the stuff that is personal and find in it the universal. That's the gig. And so he's not out here saying abuse causes queerness. He's not saying same-sex abuse causes straight men to be attracted to trans women. What he is saying, though, is that this happened to Donnie. This was Donnie's reality, and I just didn't buy it because we have to believe in the world you've created. It has to hold together internally, and it totally didn't for me.
Let's be fair, Glenn. Cis gay men are just as likely to play this little game. I'm thinking of the play The Inheritance.
Sure.
The play The Inheritance, written by a cis gay man, but it does the exact same game of wanting to only present the scandalous parts of gayness. And I would like there to be more just sort of like thought and moral complexity about if we are so interested in these things, what is the appeal of them? There's something so old school and heteronormative about just needing to slam things down and say, but it's bad.
Yeah.
I also want to say, when it comes to the question of queerness coming out of nowhere and slapping someone in the face, we should never underestimate the power of the closeted mind to screw with somebody. But for years, I was always fascinated by the number of older female comics who had figured out that they were lesbians later in life. And I was like, Is it a different experience of just sort of not putting two and two together? And I asked finally the venerable Wanda Sykes, do you just not know? And she's like, no, they knew. And it's why watching this, the notion that this is a person who wasn't in any way attracted to men or trans people, and then after the abuse, suddenly he is going to extremegayporn.uk. Seemed like, I think it's possible that he knew the URL from, like, some previous experience.
Possibly. Now, to your point, though, I mean, he does, quote unquote, go viral after a bad set when he addresses the abuse finally. And I know you have some thoughts about comedians who get famous with a bad set.
Okay, I have a lot of issues around this just because this person's profession is being a comedian. This person came to note through Edinburgh shows. I wish that this show had been funnier. And I have real trouble with representing a bad set where he just vents all of his life experience. And it's kind of embarrassing giving him all of the career that he wants and needs. You know, it is totally and completely a reference and an homage to these transformative sets that queer comics like Dick Notaro had when they got diagnosed with cancer, or Todd Glass having a heart attack and then feeling the need to come out of the closet after 20, 30 years as a comic. But these are amazing craftsmen who managed to make these extremely terrible moments very funny. And I just wish that there could have been more humor. Like, he gets halfway there. He does a lot of work to question himself and break himself down.
It's because I loved one thing in this world more than I did her, right? One thing. And do you know what that one thing was? Hating myself.
And it was a punch in the face. And the thing is that Tig Notaro would have been able to follow up that punch in the face with a line that would have eviscerated or warmed your heart in varying measures. And I just wish, I hate that it lionizes a bad set on YouTube. I think it only encourages the world of like clips of mediocre crowd work that we have bouncing around and everyone thinking that they are innovative and magical.
Yep. All right. Well, let's talk about the final episode, because we have to get through all this stuff that left me very cold to get to the final episode, which I think is a tour de force. I think it succeeds in such a brilliant, layered way. What happens is that Martha gets some jail time, not much, but that is not treated as this victory, this Law and Order SVU kind of ending where the bad person is punished. It's so much more layered than that. Talk to me about it.
Over the course of the episode, Donnie, Richard Gant's character, is brought to a point of almost echoing where Martha is in the first episode. He starts to, like, one of the things I think is really appealing about this show is the way that Martha's obsession feeds and interests him. There's a point midway through when he becomes attracted to her. He starts pleasuring himself to the memory of her obsession with him. And I thought that it was a much more complex and nuanced understanding of how sexuality actually works than what we usually see. It felt dirty and dark and awesome. And in this final episode, he sort of reaches, you know, a hard place, like in the wake of his revelation in this video. He goes and admits his queerness and his abuse to his parents, which is kind of seen as a process of being brought low. And then, Glenn, I don't know how we are supposed to take his return to the gay guy who offers him a job. Like, how are we supposed to see this as an act of profound frailty from a broken person who cannot separate himself from his abusive, like, master? Is this bad or not?
I think it's bad, and I think it's intentionally bad, and I think it's one of my favorite things about the series, because it is so messy. It is so anti-cathartic. It is not satisfying in any way. He is, when we see him at the end, he is not dealing with his trauma.
Right.
He is not. He is wallowing in it. He's walking the streets, listening to her voicemails. He takes a job with his abuser. But if it just left us there, that would be, you know, shattering, and it is still kind of shattering, but we do see him attempting to turn his experiences into the show that will ultimately be called Baby Reindeer. And that, we know, that is what's going to force him to push himself past wallowing into an act of creation, an act of transformation, and that's going to allow him to engage with his trauma in a meaningful way. He'll use it as fuel. He'll burn it so that he can move forward, but it's not happening yet.
Like, stand-up is a lot of failure. Comedy is a lot of failure. And there is this very Mrs. Maisel desire to have people go from personal failure to triumph on stage. And I loved that this show roiled in the not good, in the struggle. And the other thing about the last episode that I thought was great and interesting, after having received the job from his abuser, he goes into a bar, he orders a Diet Coke, and he does not have money to pay for it in the same way that Martha did not in the first episode. And the person who gives it to him for free is a handsome man.
Yep.
And the choice to make that a handsome man and not a handsome trans woman or a handsome cis woman, I thought was a bold placement of queerness and queer desire there. The way that he is layering that with need and desperation, like, it seems problematic in its way. And there's also a way that, like, throughout the entire series, he talks around bisexuality, but he does not present any active desire towards male-presenting people, except for a montage where he tops people. I mean, I think what we're both saying is, like, this is interesting but messy. It is a very interesting but messy show.
And I would much rather watch an interesting but messy show.
How dare you come after that Zack Snyder space opera like that, Glenn? We're not even talking about that right now.
Yeah. And nor shall we be, interestingly enough. This is a show that exists to be talked about. This is a hard sit. And yet I found, ultimately, I ended up in a place where I was satisfied with it. I was happy I watched it.
I was really happy too. But I would also say to everyone listening, as you are talking about this, please try to listen to the queer people around you and listen to the fat people around you. Like, a good discussion is good, but you also need to understand when thousands of years of prejudice are on your side, and you maybe need to listen to somebody who hasn't been as represented as you.
And to that extent, we do want to know what you think about Baby Reindeer. I've heard from some of you already. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH, and that brings us to the end of our show. Guy Branum, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode was produced by Liz Metzger and edited by Jessica Reedy. And Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR. On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.